So because this talk is centered around libraries and the book, I wanted to start it with an elegy for books. It's an elegy in four parts. The first part is called Pirates. There is a group of powerful anti-copyright activists, pirates who are trying to destroy the book. They have no respect for copyright and no respect for property. And they dress up this position in high-minded rhetoric about how they are the true defenders and inheritors of creativity. They've even sold this claim around the world to congresspeople, to members of parliament, to regulators and lawmakers. And they say that they want to preserve the way that it's always been. They claim that their radical copyright agenda is somehow conservative. But what they really see is a future in which electronic publishing grows by leaps and bounds, and they get to be at the center of it. They claim that their position is grounded in ethics, but anyone who thinks about it for a minute can see that it's really all about money and profit. Part two is called The People of the Book. We people who care about libraries are the people of the book. We love our books. We fill our houses with our books. We treasure the books we inherit from our parents. We cherish the idea of passing our books on to our children. We force worthy books onto our friends and insist that they read them. And we feel a weird sort of kinship with the people we run into on public transit, trains, and airplanes who are reading the books that we love. If anyone ever tried to take away our books, a repressive government or a mad censor or some prude, we would defend them with everything that we had. We know our tribespeople, the other people of the book, because we go to their houses and they are given over to books. The walls are lined with books. Teetering piles of books are beside the bed and randomly through the sitting room. There are swollen paperbacks, moldy with damp, in the loo. Our books are us. They are our outboard memory banks, and they contain our moral and intellectual and imaginative influences. They made us the people that we are today. And copyright recognizes this. It says that when you buy a book, it belongs to you. It is yours to give away, to keep, to lend, to borrow, to inherit, to include in your estate. For centuries, copyright has acknowledged the sacred connection between readers and their books. In fact, books are older than copyright. Books are older than publishing. Books are older than printing. And they are certainly older than things like video games and DVDs, with which they are lumped in when we just talk about copyright today, although they are clearly something different. The anti-copyright activists have no respect for books as property. They say that when you buy an electronic book or a digitally delivered audiobook, that you are demoted by fiat from being an owner to a licensor, from being a reader to being a mere user. These thieves deliver digital books and digitally delivered audiobooks wrapped in license agreements and proprietary technologies that might as well have been designed to destroy the emotional connection that readers feel with their books. These licenses can run to thousands of words. If you buy an iPhone in America and use it to buy an audiobook from the iTunes store, by doing so, you agree to 26,000 words of copyright license. That's likely larger than many of the books that they sell. And no one puts 26,000 words of license agreement in a book in order to benefit you. You could write a very short license agreement that would be respectful of copyright. It would run like this: you own this book, don't violate copyright. 26,000 words exist for one purpose and one purpose only: to confiscate the rights that copyright gives you to your books. The premise of these licenses is forget copyright. From now on, we make the rules. Parliament has no business in deciding what the rights you have to your books are. It's now private law. These licenses are, of course, filled with unenforceable clauses. They have in every one of them a clause that runs something like, should any of this license be held to be unenforceable by a competent court, the remainder remains in effect. This is a lawyer's way of saying, this license is not limited to those things that we think are lawful. Instead, it represents a kind of farcical wish list of things that many judges will laugh out of their courtrooms, but you're going to have to pay to find out which those clauses are. So on top of these licenses, we have digital rights management technology, the technology that stops you putatively from making copies. But of course, digital rights management technology has never stopped an electronic text from escaping onto the internet. To publishers who believe that digital rights management technology can be used to prevent the unfettered copying of books, I say, behold the typist. There is no mechanism by which stopping digital copies of a few bits being made can plausibly be said to be an effective means of stopping the words embodied by those bits from escaping onto the internet. Instead, what DRM has done is it's made it illegal for other people to create readers that can display the e-books that you've bought or the audiobooks that you've bought. Imagine if Borders struck a deal with IKEA to be the exclusive suppliers of reading chairs and shelves and light bulbs for the books that they sold, and then claimed the right to sue anyone who made a shelf or a chair or a book that could or a light bulb that could be used in conjunction with their books. This is, in fact, what we do with digital rights management technology. We say that, yes, this book is yours, but you may only read it on the screens that we bless. Yes, this audiobook is yours, but you may only listen to it on the devices that we bless. And, in fact, we managed to inveigle Parliament into passing laws that actually give this the force of law. But if Borders struck such a deal with IKEA, we'd laugh at them. And if it turned out that they were indeed serious about it, publishers would no doubt withdraw their works from Borders' shelves, because it's not in the interest of publishers or readers or writers to have their books locked into a vendor in this way. In fact, we can see what happens to people whose creative output is locked into one vendor. We saw it with Apple and iTunes and music, where the music industry discovered that because Apple had sold all of its music, billions and billions of dollars worth of music, locked to Apple's platform by DRM, and because it was unlawful for anyone, even people authorized by the copyright holders, to make a player that could play those DRM songs without Apple going along with it, and because Apple wouldn't go along with any scheme that would allow competition in the marketplace, the record industry essentially became a hostage to a small technology company out of Cupertino, California, no longer able to determine the characteristics of its retail channel, what it distributed where, and how it priced it, and so on. And it was only by licensing MP3s to Amazon and abandoning DRM altogether that they were able to pull out of this death spiral. And today we see the same mistake being made by publishers, only they're making it with Apple and Amazon at the same time, also with Adobe, and that's just the A's. So 90% of the audiobooks sold today are sold through an Amazon division called Audible. Audible is the exclusive supplier of audiobooks to Apple for its iTunes store. Audible exclusively sells books with DRM on. And when I briefly got Audible to agree to distribute my next book without DRM, Apple said they wouldn't sell it. So this has nothing to do, make no mistake, with defending copyright or the interests of rights holders. It's about ensuring that lock-in occurs for readers, writers, and publishers so that a mere distributor can arrogate to themselves total power over the entire industry. So part three of this talk, of this elegy, is called Saving the Book. After years of talking and writing and thinking about books, I've come to a simple but important realization. I love books. I don't just love owning them. I have a deeply sentimental attachment to the idea of books. And it's not just me. It's society-wide. If you were making a short film and you wanted to stick in a brief scene that would indicate that the society you were depicting had fallen into barbarism, you could do no better than to depict a pile of burning books. Because we know what burning books means. It means barbarism. It means a fall from grace, right? Anyone who would burn a book is clearly a barbarian. Libraries, contrary-wise, if you wanted to show a society that's ascended, you show their great libraries. I once had a fiction editor tell me that if you wanted to make a character more sympathetic, just point out how much time he spends in the library. And everyone who reads the book will immediately be overcome with sympathy for that character. There is this penumbra of virtue that surrounds the book. When I worked in a bookshop, many of you who aren't booksellers may not know this, but some books are sold on a returnable basis. And in fact, you don't have to return the whole book. The publisher doesn't want to pay for shipping. You just tear the cover off and you send the cover back, like taking trophies from the battlefield. You know, you cut off the fingers and send them back to Caesar. You cut off the cover of the book and you send it back and you pulp the book. Tearing covers off of books, even awful books, and I sold a lot of awful books when I was a bookseller, was physically painful. I can barely bring myself to recycle the phone book every year. And this is a fine place for publishing to be, to have this penumbra of virtue surrounding your product, a penumbra that's in many ways unwarranted. I mean, Theodore Sturgeon, the science fiction writer, coined something called Sturgeon's Law, 90% of everything is shit. And this certainly goes for books. I mean, there are many books that are not worth the dead trees they're printed on, and certainly the average book is a fairly unlovely example of industrial physical culture. I mean, you know, we don't print mass market paperbacks to make them beautiful. We print them to make them £6.99 and relatively disposable, and they're intended to fall apart after three reads when the binding on the glue goes because you've made the mistake of opening your book the entire way, which is, you know, a cardinal sin among readers. So publishers get a free ride on the social values surrounding books, which is great because it means that people go out and they buy books for all kinds of reasons. They buy books just to own them. They buy books just to have them on their shelves so other people will see them. They buy books because they think it will be good for their kids to grow up in a house that has these particular books on the shelves. They buy books because the Penguin Classic cover is so much nicer than the one that they have at home. They buy and they buy and they buy books, and yet publishing is set out to destroy that emotional relationship that we have with books. Publishing at the same time is paying these high-priced marketing people to come in and explain to them how you construct the experience of buying a book, the retail experience. How do you make it as pleasant as possible? They, you know, cite the iTunes store or the Disney store or the Apple store, and they say you need to build an experience around buying a book. You need to make it a kind of wonderful thing. And yet we already know what the great experience of buying a book is. It's owning that book. You know, sometimes I see people who show me digital book readers in which they've tried to imbue them with book experience. And they do things like they add an animation of a page turning when you press the scroll bar and add a little kind of page turning over sound effect. And this, to me, it's a kind of cargo cultism about the experience of books. It kind of misses the point about what we love about books. It's not the page turning. It's not the smell of the moldering paper. It's not the unlovely, horrible covers of 1960s science fiction novels. It is the fact that when you own books, you get to build a library of books. You get to acquire some of that penumbra of virtue. It's knowing that your children can inherit it. It's knowing that it came from your parents. It's knowing that it can be archived and lent and borrowed. It's knowing, for example, that the magazines that you subscribe to will remain in your possession even if you stop subscribing to them. I mean, I don't know if this is an experience in the UK, but in Canada and the United States, there is a near universal experience of discovering the attic filled with your grandparents' National Geographic magazines piled to the ceiling and spending, you know, lazy Sunday afternoons when it pours down rain outside just thumbing through them. Because when you subscribe to these, you own them. Unlike the subscriptions that digital periodical publishers peddle today, which are intended to evaporate like soap bubbles the minute you stop paying them. It's a very odd kind of subscription indeed. And given that all of those people presumably became magazine people because they had a similar experience with a giant stack of National Geographics, you have to wonder what they're thinking. It's this idea that your books are there like an old friend following you from house to house for all the days of your lives. It is an invaluable asset. But publishing is set out to teach us that we should not grow attached to our books, that we shouldn't think of ourselves as owners of books, and that someday, if we are very unlucky, they might succeed. Which brings me to part four of this elegy, which is called Respect Copyright. If we need to restore ownership to books. If I buy a book, it's mine. There is no mechanism, not even in the face of a court order, whereby a retailer can take a book away from me once I take it home. But Amazon has recently had to make probably the most bizarre promise in the history of book publishing. Many of you know that Amazon sells a digital book reader called the Kindle, and that recently they were selling through the Kindle store an edition of 1984 that may or may not have been properly licensed under copyright. And as a result of a complaint from the rights holder, Amazon took the decision to remotely delete copies of 1984 from people's Kindles after they'd purchased them. Now, leaving aside the fact that this is a near-perfect parable about the danger of e-books, right down to the title of the book that was conceivably engineered by someone like me in order to have this story to tell to you, it is a remarkable story because in the aftermath of it, Amazon did what I think many of us think of as the right thing to do. They restored people's copies of Amazon of 1984. They apologized to them, and they made the promise that they would only remove your books after you bought them if they were ordered to do so by a court. Now, no one had ever had to make this promise before, as I said. No retailer of books has ever had to promise not to come over to your house and take your books away, even if a court orders them to, because no court has ever had the ability to order people to come over to your house and take books away from you who sold them to you. Designing a device that can attract such a court order is sheer lunacy, and apparently the action of someone who's never read Chekhov and is unfamiliar with the aphorism that a gun on the mantelpiece in Act 1 is bound to go off by Act 3. We shouldn't make devices that are book readers from which books can be deleted without your permission or knowledge and against your interests. That just shouldn't be done. And until we stop designing devices that have that capability built into them, we will go on eroding this relationship that we have to books. So if I buy an audiobook on CD, it's mine. I can rip that book to WMA or AAC or MP3, and I can play it on any player I own today and any player I buy tomorrow. No license or DRM prohibits me from doing this. But again, when I went to Audible with my latest Random House audiobook, an audiobook published by the largest publisher in the world, hardly the work of patchouli-scented info-hippies, but rather something from one business to another, and asked them, can we sell this book on terms that say you bought it, you own it, just don't violate copyright with it? They said, no, we won't allow that. Through our retail channel. We love our books because they belong to us. They are our outboard intellectual coprocessors and memory units in which we store our inspiration and our fantasies and aspirations. Anyone who claims that readers can't and won't and shouldn't own their books is bent on the destruction of the book, the destruction of publishing, and the destruction of authorship. We must stop them, and we have it in our power to do so. The library of tomorrow should be better than the library of today. Its digital books should not be less capable than the books that we have today, but more capable than the books that we have today. The ability to loan the same book to two people is a feature, not a bug. We all know this. It's time we stop pretending that the pirates were right. These people were all readers before they were publishers, before they were writers, before they were agents or salespeople or marketers. We are the people of the book, and it's time we all started acting like it. So that's the end of the elegy. So now on to the talk. Copying is life. Self-replicating molecules 3 to 4 billion years ago began life by figuring out how to make copies of themselves. Copying is built in. I have a 21-month-old daughter, and when she was just a few weeks old, my mother came over from Canada. And she has a PhD in early childhood education, so she knows many mysteries about small children that I'm not initiated into. And when she got off the plane and came over to the flat and finished cooing over the baby, she was holding her in her arms, and she said, have you stuck your tongue out at her yet? And I said, no, Mom, I haven't stuck my tongue out at my two-week-old yet. Why would I do such a thing? And she said, oh, well, watch this. So she stuck her tongue out at my daughter. And does anyone know what happens when you stick your tongue out at a baby? They stick their tongue out at you. And my daughter had never seen a mirror at this point. She didn't technically know that she had a tongue. But she was hardwired to copy this gesture. It was, in fact, the first explicit communication that my daughter really had with the outside world beyond crying and pooing. And it said to me that copying is part of what and who we are. Copying is as old as the oldest things that we know about. You might go back to the first book of the Bible and read Genesis, and then go back to the ancient Babylonian myths and realize that they nicked Genesis off the Babylonians. Copying is what we do when we do best practices and standards. People who didn't copy HTML tags but instead made up their own for every web page they designed would cause unbelievable chaos. If you hired an accountant to do your books and he said, I'll be right on it as soon as I've finished inventing my own system to substitute for double entry bookkeeping because I wouldn't want to copy it, you'd fire him as quickly as you could. So copying is life. Copying is creativity. I'm a science fiction novelist today. I like to think that I'm a relatively good one. I'm certainly a relatively successful one. Little Brother, my last book, the book that's been out for a while, 90,000 hardcovers in print, 17 languages, 18 editions, because there's two English editions, one on either side of the Atlantic. Film rights sold, video game rights under negotiation, graphic novel rights under negotiation. And I've won lots of awards for it and so on. So I'm a relatively successful writer. The way I became a relatively successful writer was by copying. So the first thing I remember writing was, it was in 1977, and we'd been to see Star Wars, and I was six. And we got home, and I rounded up a bunch of paper, and I trimmed it to approximately mass market paperback size, and stapled it down the side, and got my markers, and I wrote out the story of Star Wars as I understood it. And as I remember it, I did that like several times for the next year, trying to kind of embellish the story, make it my own, understand it, trying to pick it apart and see how it worked. And I kept doing that. When I was 12, I wrote my first novel, which can only be described as Conan fanfic. I wrote a novel that was basically a thinly disguised Conan novel, laboriously in longhand in a notebook. It's the last, first and last thing, really, of any length that I wrote by longhand, that it'd be right afterwards, you know, everything was done on personal computers. But and again, it taught me a lot about writing novels, and today there are times when I'm working on novels when I think back to some of the lessons I learned by copying Robert E. Howard in order to write that novel. You know, Brian Eno has described, I think, one of the great truths about creativity. He says, try not doing the thing that nobody has ever thought of not doing. So in other words, copy what someone else has done, but leave something out and see what you get. This is a lesson that serves Steve Jobs in very good stead, because if you look at the iPod, what the iPod primarily did in order to innovate was less. Right? If you compare it to the MP3 players that were in the market when the iPod came out, what the iPod had was fewer features, fewer buttons, and therefore a certain elegance that attracted people to it by the millions, by the tens of millions, and eventually by the hundreds of millions. So what he did was he copied and left some stuff out. Copying is creativity. Copying is meaningless. We undertake millions of copies every day. Most of them, we might do 10,000 before breakfast, if you're like me and you sit down with your laptop and check your email before breakfast. Think of all the copies that are made with every click of the mouse. Think of the copy that's made at the remote end of the web server as it churns its hard drive up and writes it into a drive buffer, and then into memory, and then into a network buffer, and then into a modem, and then to a caching proxy, and then into another network buffer on your side, and then into a graphics buffer, and then to a hard drive buffer, and into RAM, and so on. Each click may be 100 copies. So copying is meaningless. It's something that is as natural and unremarkable as shedding a skin cell or breathing. But copying, paradoxically, is reified. Copyright law presupposes that an act of copying is an act of moment that is the appropriate subject matter for a rather large and unwieldy regulatory regime. After all, if you're going to copy a film in 1950... you're going to have to invest £1 million or £2 million in a great big factory and a lab and lots of specialized equipment. And it's not really that big a deal if you have to then divert 1% of your overall budget to legal advice to make sure that you don't abuse this equipment. You probably divert an equivalent amount to engineering advice to making sure it doesn't burst into flame. It's just part of the order of doing business. But we've reified copying. Because it was a good indicator that something big and industrial was going on somewhere in the creative supply chain. But because copying is now something that happens a million times a day, that big, ponderous business that is copyright law is triggered over and over again, which brings us to the next point, which is that copying is metastatic. Copying has metastasized because copying now encompasses not just what we do with creative works, but everything we do on the internet, because everything we do on the internet involves copying. So think for a moment about all the aspects of your life that you conduct on the internet. Some of you may have sent certain choice remarks to Peter Mandelson about his latest copyright proposal using the internet, or you may have applied to your local council to get a permit to add to your shed using the internet. You may be like me, an expatriate who keeps in touch with your family all over the world via the internet, or you may just keep in touch with your son who's off at uni, or your parents who are back home over the internet. It may be how you look up information about your health. Certainly as a parent, the internet has been a great source, particularly through the NHS's website, which primarily, I think, consists of a whole bunch of things that you don't have to worry about as a parent. You know, your child has broken out in tiny pink polka dots. Don't worry. Here's what's happening. It's not as bad as you think. And so health information is certainly something that we couldn't do without the internet. It's how many of us earn our income. Is there anyone in this room who could go on earning their income if they didn't have access to the internet? clearly. It's how many of us are find love, and it's how many of us research things, and so on. And because all of these activities involve lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of copying, all of them involve copyright law, which has become the de facto regulator of every corner of our life. And therein lies the disaster. Because while copyright may be a fit instrument for regulating exchanges within the supply chain of creative works, it is a completely disastrous system for regulating your personal relationship with someone you've fallen in love with on the other side of the world, or the way that you bank, or the way that you earn your living, or the way that you reserve books at the library, or the way that you take your education. So for an example, we have a proposal from Peter Mandelson for something called a three strikes regime, something that's already in place in a few European countries, Ireland and France, and has been proposed across the EU as part of the telecoms package that's being voted on tomorrow, or as early as tomorrow in the EU. The way that three strikes works is this. If you are accused of copyright infringement three times, we take away your internet connection and we add your household to a list of households that it is unlawful to connect to the internet. Now, note that I said accused, not convicted, but accused. And in France, the first draft of this law was rejected by the High Court because they said, well, that's not sufficient basis. It violates human rights to punish people without a conviction. And so Sarkozy implemented a kind of kangaroo court that would try people at the rate of every 2 minutes, would consider these requests with a special magistrate who would just kind of rubber stamp them. And bizarrely, this somehow passed muster with the French court. And so it's actually come into law in France. So the idea would be that on the strength of three acquisitions, you would stand to lose access to all of these things without even a judicial intervention, without a state-appointed attorney if you couldn't afford one of your own, without a chance to review the evidence against you or to make a case on your own behalf. This is wildly disproportionate. I mean, we wouldn't say, for example, if we thought you'd done something naughty with a photocopier three times, we come over to your house and take all your books away. That would be considered unduly draconian, I think, by most people, and rightly so. But in this case, we're not only willing to punish you for three accusations of copyright infringement, but everyone who lives with you in a form of collective punishment, something that's actually outlawed in the Geneva Conventions as the hallmark of a barbaric society. And to understand just how unfit this regime is to regulate your relationships, say to your employer, to your educational institution, to your national health service, or to your government. Imagine if this were reversed, and if we said to the entertainment industry, we are going to have three strikes for you as well. If you make three false accusations of copyright infringement, we're going to take away your entire company's internet access. We'll go over to all the Universal Music offices all over the world with a great big pair of pliers, and we'll just cut them off at the junction box. And from now on, you can do all your record label business by post. We understand that that would be a corporate death penalty, that Universal would cease to exist, because not only does delivering Universal's entertainment product involve a lot of electronic media, but paying their phone bill or keeping their heat on or leasing their offices requires this too, just as it does for you. Make no mistakes, a three strikes proposal is really the death penalty for your life as part of the digital world, as part of the information society, and yet we're proposing to bring this to the world in order to defend copyright. And this is what I mean when I say that copyright is metastasized, that copyright has gone toxic and has ceased to be merely a thing that regulates the way that people in the supply chain for creative works do business. So maximal a couple more examples of this metastatic character of copyright today. One is surveillance. So the entertainment industries have argued again and again that they should have the right to surveil some or all of the internet in order to prevent people from infringing. They've taken this argument as far as arguing that there should be no mechanism for making, say, your personal videos private to your friends and family. So Viacom, which is a big American media company, is suing YouTube, a division of Google, for infringing on their copyright. And one of their arguments that they're making is that YouTube, by having an option for people who upload videos to say, make this video only visible to my family and my friends, as I might do if I took a video of my 21-month-old daughter and wanted to show it to my parents back home in Toronto, Viacom has said that by adding this feature, YouTube is abetting infringements of copyright because once you've marked a video as private, they can no longer inspect it to see whether it infringes their copyright. So they're arguing that no one should be able to offer that service any longer, any service in which you flag video as private to your acquaintances or family, that everything should just be out there so they can make sure that they can see it. Another example of this metastatic property is the use of copyright law to enact a kind of censorship. So in 1995, the first real digital copyright laws were passed out of the World Intellectual Property Organization. These treaties came out of the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is a UN copyright body. And they included a provision for something called notice and takedown. And the way that notice and takedown works is if you host material on a web server, so you're an ISP or you're Yahoo or you're Google or you're anyone who owns a web server. Maybe you're just someone who has a web server that lets your mates put a few things on it. If you host material on the web and someone sends you a letter saying, I believe that this material infringes my copyright, they don't have to offer any proof and there's no penalty for getting it wrong, really. You have to immediately take the material down or be a party to any eventual copyright lawsuit. And in practice, the way that works is that every ISP, practically speaking, immediately takes anything that they get a notice about off the internet without really thinking about it. Because the cost of asking a solicitor, is this likely to infringe on copyright or not, probably exceeds the total value that they'll receive from any one customer of theirs over the lifetime of that customer. So they just don't bother. The Oxford Internet Institute did a very clever study where they put copies of John Stuart Mill's On Liberty on a variety of web servers across Europe and then rang them up or sent them letters saying, this is John Stuart Mill's lawyer. Can you please take my client's book down? It infringes his copyright, 1867 book. And with only one exception, the remarkable ISP in the Netherlands, Access for All, every ISP took it down. So what this turns out to be is an excellent mechanism for censorship. If there's ever anything on the web that upsets you, not because it infringes copyright, but because it upsets you, you can contact the ISP and ask them to take it down, and almost every time they'll do so, and almost every time you'll pay no consequence. Now, there are some good examples of people who've done it and ended up paying a consequence, and they serve to show you what, I guess, the outer limit of this censorship regime would be. So there's a company called Diebold, a big German-based multinational that does all kinds of different electronic machines, including voting machines. The voting machines are different from all their other machines, their EKGs and their bank machines and their cash registers and so on, because their voting machines are the only machines that don't have a paper audit tape that you can go back to and refer to if the machine crashes. An internal whistleblower wrote a memo saying, the lack of this paper audit tape is disguising the fact that these machines crash in the field all the time, and that when they do, we help the people who are running the local elections to reconstruct what they think the vote count likely was, so that they don't lose their jobs and we don't get fired for having supplied them with a defective machine. And this memo circulated widely on the internet, and Diebold claimed not that it was untrue or that it violated some trade secret, but because the memo was written by one of their employees, it was a breach of their copyright because it was a work made for hire, and that they had the right, therefore, to order people to not publish this memo on the eve of an election when it was of some moment and note. Diebold eventually paid a penalty for this. The EFF, my former employer, sued them and won a judgment of $225,000 against them. It was remarkable because it's one of the very few cases in which an abusive use of these notice and takedown regimes actually got any kind of substantial punishment. And in most cases, they don't. For example, the Church of Scientology routinely uses very dubious takedown notices to make anyone who criticizes their practices disappear from the internet. And so it's for these reasons that I say that this maximal abusive view of copyright that says more copyright is always better, and copyright is the right thing to regulate what we do non-commercially or with one or another, or when we copy, no matter how we copy on the internet, that these people are wrong. But maximal abusive, mindless copyright expansion isn't just a disaster for the public, it's also a disaster for artists. First, because it locks them into the distribution oligopoly. As we heard when I talked about the iTunes, Audible, Amazon kind of axis of distribution, distribution is where all the action is in creative works. A distribution bottleneck gives an enormous amount of power to the distributor over everyone else in the supply chain. So to get an example of how that works, say, in the music industry, today, if you want to sample music in order to make a new work, that is, take a snippet of it and reuse it in some way, and you are signed to one of the four major record labels, it's not that hard to do. Chances are one in four that any sample you want to clear is already in your label's catalog, because there's four of them. And if it's not, well, they just call up their opposite number at some other label and they say, hey, Bob, it's Fred. Do you remember that deal we did last week? I want to do it again, but in reverse. Instead of your artist licensing my sample, I'm going to license yours. I'll just cross your name out and cross my name out and reverse them and send you back the contracts. And when you hear people from the record industry talking about sampling, they always say, well, I don't see what the big deal is. It's trivial to clear a sample. But if you're not in the record label system, it's likely impossible or nearly impossible to clear a sample because, A, the costs are very high, and, B, chances are they won't pick up the phone and answer you when you make a license query. This often happens when people approach these very big entities for a one-off license because they don't have a standard deal they can offer you, paying the solicitor or paying the attorney to write up a license agreement and go through the negotiation with you for a few thousand pounds or a few thousand dollars is not worth it. They lose money in the bargain. So it's just impossible. Well, what this has the effect of doing is locking artists who wish to sample into either being illegal, in which case they really can't market their wares and they can't make a living at it, or accepting the deal that's offered to them by one of the four labels, which means that they have to accept really what's one of the most abusive contracts being offered in the system today. I talked before about how the people who sell you a creative work on the internet have this fiction that it's not a sale but a license. And nowhere is that more evident than in the standard record deal. So a standard record deal gives the artist 7% of all sales and 50% of all licenses. So if you buy a CD for £16, they get 7% of that. But if you license a track from that CD to put in your movie for £5,000, they get 50% of it. When you buy a song from iTunes, you get this long, multi-thousand-word license agreement that tells you that you are a licensor and that you're not making a purchase, although you never hear them at music conferences saying music licenses were up 500% last year. They say music sales, digital music sales, were up 500% last year. And indeed, when they go to the artist, they say, actually, that wasn't a license that would get you 45p out of the 89p that came from the iTunes store. Sale. No, it was a sale, in which case you get about 6p. So they kind of keep 6/7 of the money themselves, right? So this is this very abusive contract. No one can really get out from under it for so long as sampling music requires you to do a deal with one of the four labels. And today we have a proposal in the European Union to add 45 years of copyright to sound recordings. Now, what's going to happen when the 45 years are added to sound recordings is what happens to anyone who's given a weapon that they don't know how to use, who's then mugged on a dark alley, which is that their attacker takes it away from them and uses it against them. In this case, the record labels will say, oh, an extra 45 years of copyright tacked onto your composition? I'll have that. Right? And what it will mean is that if you want to sample works that are 95 years old, you're going to have to enter the system as well and accept this deal as opposed to merely sampling works that are 50 years old. And it will strengthen this oligopoly. So it's bad for artists in that way. It's also bad for artists because artists are among the most prolific owners, users, and reusers of creative works. I've yet to meet a writer whose house wasn't filled with teetering piles of books. I've yet to meet a musician whose house wasn't filled with teetering piles of CDs and music. I've yet to meet a painter whose house wasn't filled with visual works. We as creators are, in fact, very prolific users. And this pretense that there's a difference between a user and a creator ignores the reality of creation. And then third, this kind of mindless reaching towards more copyright to solve every problem is bad because copying creates opportunities where none existed before. The title of this talk is Think Like a Dandelion, and that came out of a talk I had with a friend of mine who's an actor who put some videos of some of the TV work he'd done up on the web, and they ended up on YouTube, and they were being screened on YouTube, and he wasn't sure how he'd make any money off of them, and he'd asked people to buy the DVD, and the videos were being downloaded millions of times, but the DVDs were only selling dozens or hundreds of times, and we were both about to have our first child then. This was a couple of years ago, and I said, you know what your problem is? Your problem is that you're thinking about your reproduction like a mammal. And speaking as a mammal who's about to reproduce, I can tell you we take reproduction very seriously. We want to have a lot of say. We want to have a lot of business with the output of our reproduction process. We want to know that it actually goes somewhere and does something. We dote on our reproduced entities. By comparison, dandelions don't really care about their offspring. The idea of a dandelion that blows 2,000 seed into the air when the breeze comes along is not to ensure that every seed germinates, but rather that every opportunity for germination is capitalized upon, that is exploited, that every crack has a dandelion growing out of it come spring. And that's, that strategy is extremely successful if it doesn't cost you much to reproduce. And on the internet, when your fans take your videos and put them on YouTube, they no longer cost you anything to reproduce. YouTube may be losing $1.5 million a day, if you believe the Gartner analysts, but certainly you don't have to pay any piece of that. And the more successful your video is, you still don't have to pay anything more for those videos to be spread around. Now, thinking like a dandelion has done me great advantage on the internet with my own books. As you heard, all my books are made available on the internet as free downloads the same day that they're offered in print in shops from major publishers. HarperCollins here in the UK, owned by Rupert Murdoch, hardly someone you think of as a free spirit. The reason that we do this is because we believe it sells more books, because print books are not readily substituted for by electronic books, because the experience of reading an electronic book is inferior in a lot of ways. Not least is that you either have to shell out £300, £250 for a dedicated purpose electronic book reader, which is very expensive and is one more thing that you have to carry around in your already overstuffed gadget bag, or you have to try and read your ebooks on a device that does a million things, like an iPhone. In which case, if you're anything like me, you find that 3 minutes into reading the novel, you're checking your email, or you're looking at RSS, or you've just discovered that there's someone on YouTube putting a lemon in his nose. And as a result, unless you have the iron self-discipline of a monk, or you have no other choice, chances are you're not going to finish a novel on your iPhone. Chances are that if the novel is available and it's cheap, which novels are, you will just nip out to the shop and buy it, or you'll order it off of Amazon. And so in my experience, I sell more books than I displace through these free downloads, and that works for now. Now, it may not work forever, and at this point, someone always says, well, what if the Kindle became, you know, just a tenner, and it was as floppy as a piece of paper, and you could crumple it up and stick it in your pocket like a used facial tissue and snap it out, and the battery lasted for 100,000 hours. What then? And I say, you know, I'll burn that bridge when I come to it, but I certainly think that I will be better equipped to figure out what the next thing to do to make money off of electronic text will be if I'm thoroughly engaged with how people use electronic text than if I'm some sort of refusenik sitting at the door of my writing office saying, no books for you until you all agree to start using technology in a way that's maximally beneficial to me. Those people, I think, will find themselves with no instincts at all for what the next opportunity will be. There is a kind of fallacy that we are in a period of technological transition, which implies that at the end of the period of technological transition, we will enter a period of technological stability. There is no period of technological stability on our horizon, barring nuclear war. Technological stability is a thing of the past. What works today will, I guarantee, cease to work tomorrow. What works tomorrow will, I guarantee, cease to work the day after. We will continually have to find new things to do. Publishing has found new things to do for generations already. Changes in distribution, changes in setup, changes in the market have caused publishing to reinvent itself in lots of ways behind the scenes that weren't really visible to the general public, but were certainly wrenching enough for publishers. And they seem to have forgotten that. They seem to have bought into the myth that publishing hasn't changed substantially since, you know, the first person opened the first bookseller. And in fact, it's changed rather a lot in that period. I'm lucky enough that I work in a medium in which the electronic edition is not a ready substitute for the physical edition, and so I can give away ebooks to sell print books. Musicians who are also performers are lucky enough to inhabit a medium in which they can substitute selling a physical good for selling a performance. Performances are inherently scarce. If I want you to pay for a recording of a performance and you don't want to pay for it, to some approximation, there's nothing I can do to stop you. I mean, it's, you know, copying's not going to get any harder from here on in. You will figure out how to go to Google and type in Cory Doctorow lecture BitTorrent, and you will have the copy of the lecture. And I, you know, no amount of stamping my whittle foot in frustration will actually change that technical reality. On the other hand, stopping you from hearing this lecture live is pretty trivial, right? I just get a couple of beefy people at either door, and if you don't pay for your ticket, they don't let you in. Right? It works. Now, it used to be that concerts were lost leaders for records. Now it looks like recordings are lost leaders for concerts. Technology giveth and technology taketh away. 70 years ago, vaudevillians were put out of work by recording artists. Today, recording artists are being put out of work by vaudevillians. You know, in 10 years, maybe all of our music will come in injection form, and we'll all be put out of work by nurses' aides. Nevertheless, technology giveth and technology taketh away, and there's no denying the fact that last year was the best year ever for live performance of all description. It had the largest mega concerts. It had the largest number of non-mega concerts. It made more money than live performance had ever made. Now, certainly there will be people who don't survive this change. There will be musicians who are inherently studio musicians who see themselves as white-collar workers who labor indoors and slide their work under the door when they're done so some bourgeois man of commerce can introduce it to their audience. And those people will have to give way to the trained monkeys who like to caper on stage, just as 70 years ago, the trained monkeys who capered on stage said, well, I do something old and holy, and you want me to go and be a mere clerk. I refuse to do it. And they ended up, you know, driving taxis or flipping burgers. It's just how it goes. The purpose of law, the purpose of policy, shouldn't be to ensure that yesterday's winners go on being tomorrow's winners. The purpose of law and policy in cultural realms should be to ensure that the greatest diversity of participation in culture is possible. There has never been a time when it's been easier for an artist to find an audience, thanks to all this copying, thanks to thinking like a dandelion. So every industry has some story like this. And what I found from thinking like a dandelion is that the seeds blow into the most unlikely places. I get a fair bit of email from people serving on naval ships, where there is essentially no literature, but there are laser printers and internet connections. They download my books, they print them out, they pass them around, they come back to base or they come back to home, and they buy my books. I just got an email from a guy who was an American military interrogator on an advanced fire base in Afghanistan who found that he didn't have anything to read during the long periods of boredom punctuated by short periods of utter terror, and so he downloaded all my books, became a fan, gave up being a military interrogator, decided to become a copyright lawyer to fight for justice and copyright, moved back to America, enrolled in university, and is now spending his discretionary income on buying copies of my books. I've heard from any number of students who said, I read your books. Now that it's been a good while, 6 years, I'm starting to hear from students who started reading my books for free when they were poor students and are now buying them now that they are people with jobs. And when I worked in a bookshop, I saw this with great clarity, that books buying it goes according to life cycles, the same kind of life cycles that the great marketing houses of the world have identified, like Procter & Gamble, which, you know, really revolutionized selling by saying we need to market differently to people who are just starting out in life and buying their first home or just getting married than we do to people who are in middle age, than we do to people who are retired, and so on. And they all have specific needs, and we need to figure out a way to target them differently. When I was working as a bookseller, you could see the life cycle of people who were kids who didn't have any money, who'd only buy used books and would put their name down if a used copy of a new release came in. They wanted to come in and buy it at 50% of the cover price, who would then graduate and go on and get a good job, and then they'd want to buy all the books in hardcover, and then they become pensioners or they'd have kids and they wouldn't have any money again, and they go back on the used books. That's just the life cycle of book readers. If you cut them off at the beginning, if you say there are no cheap editions, there's no way for you to sample when you don't have any money, then when they do have money, they'll go out and spend it on other stuff that they were able to sample when they were kids. They'll go off and spend it on video games or whatever else it was that caught their habit when they were young and starting out. So I hear a lot from students now who are going out and buying my books. And what I hear also a lot from is people who are participating in online communities where my books have wormed their way in. So my latest book is called Makers, and it's about people who make inventions, hardware, after the economy collapses, because it turns out that you can make hardware inventions very cheaply today because there's so much commodity stuff lying around. And you know, there's huge amounts of commodity goods that have come over from the Pacific Rim, and there's 3D printers and lots of ways that we can kind of recombine them in exciting ways. And it really mirrors this whole hack lab maker culture that we have all over the world today, where people are inventing new things and trading notes over the internet about how to refine those inventions. And I'm hearing from those people already saying, you know, this has worked its way into my social circle. We're passing copies of the file around. We're passing copies of the book around. We're buying copies of the book. We're finding interesting ways to use the book. We're printing out things that we see in the book, making 3D printouts of things described in the book. We're using it. And what they're describing really is a kind of social economy in which the copying is not just something that happens in that kind of passive bureaucratic mistakes were made voice, a copy occurred. Rather, every one of these copies involves a social transaction. I made a copy for you. And that I made a copy for you transaction is the most powerful thing that we have as artists. It is a way of saying, I think that this work is worthy for you. It will strengthen our social bond. It will have a sentimental value to both of us. And it will be part of our shared vocabulary as we unpick the world as it seems and attempt to understand it. And that is really a very valuable thing for artists to have. And it's the most valuable thing that comes out of this dandelional thinking. But as the elegy reminded us, I hope, publishers have set out to destroy that emotional connection, to tell us that we can't own our books and shouldn't be attached to them. So this is the part of the talk where I ask you to do something. Here in the UK, we have the Open Rights Group, which is an excellent organization that I co-founded, but which I don't have anything to do with the daily running of. It's excellent not because of anything I do. And it's excellent not least because it keeps its membership up to date on dangerous changes to copyright law in the European Union and in the UK, and coordinates extremely successful campaigns to contact MPs and MEPs and to ensure that these laws are held back. You can join for a fiver a month, and or you can get on the mailing list for free, whatever is at your level, depending on where you are in your life cycle. But supporting Org and its work, Open Rights Group and its work, is critical to keeping the network free and open and to ensuring that artists and readers and publishers continue to have this platform that grows and continues to expand our individual capacity and our capacity to work as groups. There's also, of course, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which works here in Europe as well, as does the Free Software Foundation in Europe. If you are a creator, or if you're an academic, or if you make things, you can license those things under ways that are freely copyable. You can basically reject the part of the copyright system that says that the interactions between your readers or the interactions between your readers and you should be regulated by the same rules that interact that regulate your interactions between you and your publisher or you and the film company or record label that represent you. And you can say, no, we need a different system. We need a system that, it's not to say that we shouldn't have any rules, but we should have different rules that are more moderate. And the Creative Commons licenses from creativecommons.org are very easy to use, very easy to understand, aimed at the laity. You don't have to be a copyright lawyer to grasp them, and they give you a lot of flexibility in that regard. If you're a musician, you can join up with the Featured Artist Coalition, which is a coalition of musicians that are involved in showing that there isn't a consensus on maximally expanding copyright at the expense of the public. Musicians from Billy Bragg to Sinead O'Connor to Blur and other groups and individuals have joined up to stop these three strikes proposals and other proposals and putting a lie to the idea that there is one voice for artists and that they want one thing is really important to changing this debate, because right now it's being characterized as artists versus the public. And in some ways, the record labels who really stand to benefit from it are using the artists as human shields to absorb all the ill will. So this is good for artists as well to kind of break with that consensus. One important thing that you can do tonight or tomorrow morning is to call or write to your MEP about the telecoms package. If you go to the Open Rights Group homepage, you'll find information about this. The telecoms package is scheduled to go up tomorrow. It contains three strikes, and if it's passed, all of Europe will be subject to a telecoms regulation. If you're at the uni here, you can get involved with founding a Free Culture chapter. Free Culture is an international network of student organizations in secondary schools and in tertiary institutions like universities and colleges that works to do on-campus activities and education and outreach programs and projects that promote the cause of free culture. And if you buy books for your collection, if you're a librarian or if you're a scholar and you're buying books for your collection, don't buy ebooks or audiobooks that have abusive terms on them. Demand better terms from your suppliers. Collectively, libraries are too important a customer for the electronic publishers to ignore. And certainly for things like electronic journal subscriptions, there's no customer bigger than academic and scholarly libraries. If we speak with one voice and refuse to accept these abusive terms, they will change because they can't afford, their shareholders won't allow them to refuse to sell us the product that we want to buy. We want a fair deal. So your digital future is at stake, and I hope that you'll take some action as a result of what you've heard tonight. Thank you.